Blog Talk Radio.
Another great episode we have for Suspense Radio. I am your host, John Robb, and this is one of these shows today I'm bringing to you that it is fabulous to be a guest and be able to bring it to you. We have first coming up is going to be author James Rollins, then we're going to have author David Morrell, and then we're going to come back with Brian Gurley, all in this 90-minute Suspense Radio powerhouse author segment that's coming up right now.
Welcome to my nightmare. I think you're gonna like it. I think you're gonna feel you belong.
Welcome back, and here we go. I want to introduce our first guest who's getting ready to go on one of his extravaganzas like he always does, and a new book comes out, and the new book is called Bloodline. It is the next series in the Sigma series that New York Times bestselling author James Rollins writes, and we're so thankful to have James come to the show. So, James, how are you doing?
I'm doing fantastic.
Wonderful. So, like we said, this is Bloodline, and this is now the eighth book in your Sigma series. It just keeps rolling along, bigger every time. You feel the pressure every time. You're going out on this huge tour. So tell everybody a little bit about Bloodline, kind of the Sigma series, how it's kind of come up to this point. Because we interviewed you for the magazine, you said the next one, all bets are off. So you got some stuff in the pipeline also coming up.
Yeah, I mean, for this book coming out this summer, Bloodline, the Sigma team has to rescue the president's daughter. You know, that seems sort of maybe like a little bit of a people have done that before, rescuing various members of the presidential family. But I've been building up to this book for pretty much the arc of the series. Mm-hmm. There's been an organization that's been plaguing Sigma since book number one, and this is the ultimate culmination of that eight-book arc. This is the final confrontation between the Guild and Sigma. This is where we find out, you know, who the true puppet masters of this organization are, and it's a big showdown between these two big organizations.
Yeah, when you're writing, so, and like you said, the eight-book arc started back with Sandstorm kind of moving up here forward. Devil Colony was the book right before Bloodline. And when you know that you're going to be building something up like this and it's going to be going, how hard is it to pace yourself? I mean, how fast do you want to say, God, I just want to get there, I want to get there, because it's so, you know, it's kind of like the exciting part to be able to get everything together in the big explosion. How does that do? How do you have to do it as an author to kind of slow back, pace yourself, kind of, you know, spoon-feed everything that's going on and kind of give a little here, give a little there, and have it all come together in eight books?
Well, definitely, there's certain key moments in the series that I have been anxious to get to. I mean, there are certain scenes in this book that I knew when I started the first book that I wanted to sort of explode and to be revealed. Huge, gigantic secrets that come out in this book. And so, yeah, I was definitely anxious to get to that. But in regards to this pacing, you know, on a day-to-day basis, I'm a very regimented writer. I require myself to write 5 double-spaced pages every day. And in 5 pages, not a whole lot will happen in the course of the story. So that somewhat puts the reins on me, simply the fact that I've got to produce these 5 pages. And you work incrementally towards those big scenes. And again, even during those 5 pages, there's always something I want to get out in those 5 pages. You know, you shouldn't be writing 5 pages just for no purpose.
Right.
It usually is those mini moments that you get to capture every day. As I probably indicated, there's a big, gigantic skeletal arc for the series, and that applies to the books, too. I know where books begin. I know where they end. I know a few of the mileposts between beginning to end, but I don't necessarily know how A connects B connects to C. There's those minute details between those mileposts. And for me, that's the joy of a writer, is to sit with my 5 pages those days, sometimes not knowing what's going to happen in those 5 pages and discovering it then. So, again, there's that mixture of anticipation of getting to those exciting scenes, but it's also the joy of that discovery you get every day from writing.
Yeah, and when you're talking about, like you said, you have like a skeletal outline, so you kind of know how it's going to start, you kind of know how it's going to end, but then the whole middle can kind of get, you know, cluttered up a little bit. And I wrote something in the magazine that's going to be coming out here in July that was about writer's block. And even though sometimes, you know, there's outline an authors like an Alan Jacobson who's very much an outline author and he puts everything down. How do you, when you're going through and new authors are kind of coming up and they just kind of get that, how do you fight through that wall of writer's block when you're kind of in the middle and you can kind of see it or it's maybe changed a little? How do you fight through all that?
Well, there's 2 things. Number one is the simple fact that there's a deadline. Believe me, that's a lot of motivation right there. But more practically, even deadlines, they can lose their punch. And the key for me to avoid that writer's block, that point where I can't write, with the moments where I've discovered where I've been close to that point is usually those moments in the story where I think I have to write perfection. And that will set you for a bad course. So I've got a little post-it note sitting on the side of my computer monitor. It says, "Today I give permission to write crap." Now, I use something more colorful than crap, but I won't put that over the air. Because I've got to let myself go to know that today I don't have to write perfection. I just have to write pages. And that, to me, is one way of getting over the writer's blocks. But, I mean, for me, every single book, and I'm still waiting. I've written 25 books. I'm still waiting for the one book, when I get to the middle of the book, that I think the book is good. Never happens. Middle of the book,
right.
I'm convinced I've lost all talent. I've lost the ability to write. This book is crap. It will never sell. My fans are going to burn me in effigy. But you just have to, you know, do that 5 pages of the day. I got to write 5 pages today, and I've got my little note permission to write crap today if I have to get to those 5 pages, and that will get you through that.
And what you've also done here is you released this on June the 5th, so this is also very kind of new, is you released the Stigma Guide. And would you recommend, so someone who's kind of listening new and doesn't really kind of understand like who the Stigma series is, they're like, oh, God, there's 8 books into it, this and that. Is the Stigma Guide something that they should get, and can they read that before? Is it something that they go ahead and they say, okay, this is a guide to take you through the series to maybe kind of fill in the blanks a little bit? Tell a little bit about, like, what is the Stigma Guide?
Well, Stigma Guide is sort of a general outline. It's sort of the nuts and bolts of the characters, of the series. I do give sort of I don't give away the story, but there's general, like, what happens in each book that's key to the series. I was very delicate about dancing. I worked with Greg Cox, a great writer, on building this guide together. And we were like, okay, now let's not give this away. Let's, you know, what can we say about this book that won't give the whole, that won't make somebody go, gosh, I read the outline, I read the cliff notes of that book, I don't need to read the book. We don't want that to happen. So for basically the reason we did this guide was simply that there was a lot of clamoring for something like this, because it's a pretty big universe, and a lot of people were, you know, wanting to have, you know, one source in which they can go to get some details of the story. Now, when I write a book, each book stands alone. They each have the beginning, middle, and end. But there's a sort of a bigger arc that crosses through the series. But, I mean, I would say probably 75% of the people that have encountered my series have never read them in order. They'll jump in at a certain book. They'll enjoy it. They'll go back and read the earlier books. They'll move forward. They'll jump them. They'll read them out of order. And you can enjoy the series in that respect also. But to sort of capture that arc, I thought, since we are concluding this big arc, let's give a guide to go with this so you can sort of see, have a resource, a handy resource. We'll be updating that as time goes on. It's free. Just download it from my website. it gives you sort of a continual moving picture of the Sigma world.
And I want to remind everybody here, we're speaking with author James Rollins, and the website is jamesrollins.com. The new book in the Sigma Force series is called Bloodline. It comes out on June the 26th, wherever everything is available to be bought. Now, when you kind of look back and you're kind of looking at the eight books, was there one kind of character that when you were kind of collaborating and getting the series together that kind of jumped out at you to say, I had no idea that this character was going to either be this big of a voice or be this beloved or be this hated by fans, that kind of surprised you in that way?
That probably would be my character Kowalski. He served somewhat as comic relief, and that's the way I introduced him. He actually first appeared in my standalone novel, Ice Hunt, and I liked him so much just writing him because he was a fun comic relief character. He's a big oafish sort of guy. He's got some great one-liners. And I thought, well, I'm going to pull him forward into this new novel. So I pulled him into the Sigma series. I believe he first appeared in Black Order. I can't even remember when he first appeared. But early in the series, not in the first book, but I think it was like the second or third book in the series, I pulled him forward. Mm-hmm. And I liked writing him. I enjoyed him. But the fan reaction to him was really, really positive. So he's become, a staple of the series. And even he was trying to find out that big oafish persona he puts on is hiding actually a pretty sharp guy, somebody that is maybe playing the oaf to his own benefit.
Now, and kind of the other thing that you did, and a lot of people might realize when they go on your website, again, jamesrollins.com, is you also wrote another, I mean, you've been extremely busy. I mean, there's guides, and you have Bloodline and the new Sigma series. You also wrote another book here. Because you did something, you went on the USO tour with Andy Harp, you were with David Morrell and others, and you were out there with Steve Barry. And a lot of people might not realize the kind of impact that you guys had when you went out to visit the troops. And you wrote here a story called Tracker, which is a short story exclusive, which again came out on June the 5th. What was, I don't want to say the inspiration, but was a little bit about like the USO trip and those kinds of things? Was that kind of behind getting this kind of book? Because it's a little different than people are going to realize from what you had written.
Right. Many people might not know this, but I'm a veterinarian in my real life. I write full time now, but I still do some volunteer work. And I was a practicing veterinarian for 20 years. And so when I went on the USO tour, when we were visiting some of the bases in Iraq and Kuwait, I saw some of the military working dogs out in the field, and being a veterinarian, that's what I sort of zeroed in on. I'm like, oh, look, dogs. So I talked to some of the handlers, and I was really struck by the bond that they had between dog and handler. I was wondering, do they just treat their dogs like a sidearm? Is their dogs just military hardware to them? And what I discovered was that dog to them is close to them as any human. The person that they work alongside with. I mean, I've heard lines like, my dog knows me better than my wife does. So it was that bond that I was really sort of struck by. And I thought, I would like to try to capture this pair of heroes, a handler and his military war dog, try to honor them on the page, try to just shed a little bit of light on them. What I also wanted to do with this book, being a veterinarian, is that I want to try to capture what it was like actually to be that dog. In both Tracker, the short story, and both Tucker and Kane, the army, handler and his dog appear in Bloodline. I've written several scenes from the dog's perspective. I did a lot of research about the emotional world dogs experience, how they view the world, how they experience the world. I wanted to try to capture that and try to see, put my readers in the paws of that dog. What is it like to hunt, to protect, to fight alongside somebody? What is that relationship like? And that was my goal, both Tracker, which sort of was my experiment with that pair of characters. I wrote Tracker first just to see, what are these characters like? Who is this guy like? Who is this former Army Ranger? What's this dog like? And I liked them so much that when I started writing Bloodline, I knew I had to introduce a new set of characters, and I thought this is the perfect set of characters to bring forward into Sigma.
And just from everything that you've written and you've been involved in, and you brought in so many different things, and so many different, I guess, aspects, because your books are, it's tough to kind of say. I mean, they're thrillers, and you got everything that's going on around them, because you have now you have this gigantic series of eight books, and when you kind of look at it, I mean, it's thousands upon thousands of pages. Did you have any idea, of course, when you wrote back and you wrote Sandstorm, that the significance of what Sigma Force has become now a part of your life was going to be the way that it was, or that it is?
Not at all. I mean, when I wrote Sandstorm, I did not think that was the beginning of a series. All my books prior to Sandstorm were standalones, and mm-hmm. Sigma and Sandstorm was I just wrote that as a standalone. I introduced the team of Sigma in that book, and Sigma is a group of ex-Special Forces soldiers that have been retrained in various scientific disciplines, and basically scientists with guns. And I sort of liked that team, and I had been resistant about doing a series for a while. I got a fair amount of pressure from my house, too, so maybe try doing a series, but I just didn't appeal to me. I wanted to have each book be a brand set of characters, a brand new adventure. But once I encountered Painter Crow and Sigma, I thought, you know what, I can build a series based on this group, mostly because of what I call the Jessica Fletcher syndrome from Murder, She Wrote.
Yeah.
You know, Jessica Fletcher stumbles across a body every single week.
Poor
I've never
girl.
Stumbled across a dead body, but she's doing it every single week, and eventually that wears upon the suspension of disbelief to think that she's stumbling across that many dead bodies.
Right.
Now, personally, I thought the final episode of Murder, She Wrote was going to be the reveal that she's actually a serial killer and that she's been framing all these people over the years. So I was quite disappointed.
Right.
So to me, you know, I need to get an idea for a series where the jeopardy can come from many different directions. You know, with a team, any of the teammates can bring the jeopardy forward rather than one person. Also, as much as you want Jessica Fletcher to die every episode of Murder, She Wrote, she doesn't, because you know she's going to be in next week. So that, again,
right.
you know, reduces the jeopardy if you think that character is going to be around every single week. Whereas the team, again, they're not irreplaceable. I mean, I can kill off one of the teammates and, you know, just recruit another teammate. So there's a certain level of jeopardy I can maintain by having a team. So when I created Sandstorm and I realized I had, you know, a team that I could work with, a team that where jeopardy can come from different directions, a team where, you know, I could put everybody in jeopardy, that's when I thought I could make a series out of this.
And, again, we're speaking here with author James Rollins. The newest book coming out June 26th, which is Tuesday, is Bloodline, which is book 8 in the Sigma series, where James has, you know, brought the climax to a whole new level here. You've also got some other things, and you write on your website, jamesrollins.com, that, you know, and let's just talk about your newsletter, because you have a lot of different things. And it says on here, you know, that you have monthly giveaways, exclusive news, but then you say you have research clues and more and missing chapters. What if somebody signs up to sit there and you can click right to subscribe, put in your email address, and you get it? What are some of those little things that you are talking about, like research clues and missing chapters and things that exclusively you're going to give your fans that sign up?
Well, basically, I'll use this example. There's the main minor characters in the Sigma series is a minor, she's fairly major, is a is a female assassin named Seishan. Well, Seishan, most people don't know, actually had her first appearance in my very first book, Subterranean. But she ended up on the cutting room floor. Her scene was early in the novel. She does something that's very critical to the story. It was very painful for me to cut that scene out. I belong to a critique group here in Sacramento. That was one of their favorite scenes, was that scene. So, you know, her with her little silver dragon necklace that she wears in the Sigma series, you know, that was, she was wearing that back in Subterranean. She makes that appearance. So, again, one of the giveaways I give out is that lost Seishan scene from Subterranean. So there's some of those things on the cutting room floor that I thought were, you know, pretty vital to the story, that I thought were significant, that my editor thought was maybe slowing things down or unnecessary. I don't throw those away. I do have a tendency to keep those, resurrect them, or in this case, share them with people that either join me on Facebook or sign up for the newsletter. There's a lot of little sort of hidden things behind the scenes that I try to reveal and share.
And are those kind of the things going forward? Because now that ebooks are becoming such a huge part of just everybody's reading, I know that you wrote the Sigma Guide, but now is it also something in your head where you're able to kind of take some of these things and some of these bridges and bridge with these Evella novels to gap some of whatever, and you know, when you're going through the 8-book series, to kind of gap some of maybe the gaps that you did have that might not either be explained or people talk about. Are you going to start utilizing it that way also with ebooks?
Definitely. I mean, even with these these short stories, I'm allowed to do little things that maybe weren't. Sometimes I get ideas for ways to connect one book to another book, but it's a small idea. It doesn't really fit into a novel format. there was never a vehicle for giving that story out. But with e-books, you know, now, you know, it's very easy to write them, give them away for free, you know, put them on for 99 cents. You know, the one thing that e-books has done is sort of changed the landscape of, you know, our ability to what is defined as product. It usually be useful, you know, your book once a year. That's all you got from that author. But now there's a lot more interaction through Facebook, through social media. But also now with e-books, there can be some that quick and immediate intimacy. Like, I could never have done a Sigma guide because it's only 100-some-odd pages, a Sigma guide. Definitely couldn't have done it in a print format. So this at least allowed me to give something back to my fans and my readers without the commitment of trying to do a print product.
And the other thing that you do that you're very, you know, I wrote, you're one of the most engaging authors when fans pull up and meet you. And you're still one of the ones who do a gigantic book tour. And you're out there, and like I said, so, and the book tour starts on Tuesday, and you're going to be in California, and then you're heading to Texas, and you're going all over the place. Is this something that you sit there and you say, hey, I need to hit different states for different books, because you can't hit them all. And you kind of try to go through, and if people read your FAQ questions, you know, they'll realize that you just can't go to all 50 states all the time. So you kind of sit there and say, okay, this time I'm going to start going to this part of the country and this and this and this, and kind of go around that way to try to give everybody a little bit of taste to be able to meet you at least in the couple of years of being able to go through the series?
Yeah, definitely. That is one particular goal of my house and myself, is to mix it up, is not, you know, certain places you're going to hit almost every single time you go on a book tour. But then the other places we change. Like this time I'm going to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I'm going to Kansas City. I'm going to Lansing, Michigan. Things that I've never – places I've never been to before. Matter of fact, I'm going to St. Louis, which oddly enough, you know, I was went to junior high school and college in Missouri. This is the first time I'm actually going back to Missouri for a book tour.
Wow.
So that, again, gives you some indication of how hard it is to get everywhere across these 50 states. You know, I have a personal connection to Missouri, but this is my first time after, you know, 12 years with Harper that I'm actually going to be going to Missouri. But one thing I do also do, like this first book tour here, first book engagement, book talk, is here in Sacramento, and I'm filming it. I did this the last two tours also, so that people that maybe can't attend one of the events, we do film it, tape it, and I do post it up on my website in chunks, little mini chunks, so that you can actually hear the talk I give every year for that particular book. So if you don't happen to not be able to make that tour, one of those tour stops, at least, you know, there's a vehicle in which you can actually experience the tour in some manner or another.
Well, James, I want to thank you so much for coming on. One of the hardest working men in writing today, Mr. James Rollins, with your website. You have videos, you got everything going out there. The book is Bloodline, comes out on Tuesday, the 8th in the Sigma series, where let's face it, shit's going to hit the fan coming, just like you're always going to do it.
That's a great definition right there.
And that was good. So, James, we want to thank you so much for coming on. Enjoy yourself. Get some rest, because you got a lot of stuff coming up, and, you know, you're going to be at Thriller Fest and everything else out there. So we will, catch up with you later and have a lot of fun.
All right. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. Have a good one. All right. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is author James Rollins, and the book is called Bloodline, and it comes out on Tuesday. It is the latest in the Sigma series. JamesRollins.com is the site. A lot of things that you can go on and view to get involved, especially with his writing, his individual series, and he has a kids adult series, short story collaboration. Like he said, 25 books down and still going strong, one of the hardest working men in writing out there today, and one of the best. If you haven't discovered him, I don't know if you're a thriller reader then. So we're going to go ahead and go on, and our next guest is going to be coming up here shortly, which is author David Morrell. Those of you who are familiar with David, you should know that David was the creator of Rambo, which was made famous by Sylvester Stallone on the screen, and David wrote three of those books. But David also has done a lot of other writing. He, you know, Brotherhood of the Rose, The Shimmer, a lot of his books. He just did an Amazon exclusive digital, The Naked Edge, which was one of the first ones to ever do that. I think he was the first one to ever do that. We had him on talking about that. So he's going to be joining us here shortly. In the meantime, you're going to have some musical interlude, so you can sit here and enjoy this one.
Mm-hmm. glamour, celebrity, and murder. Whether you're looking for mystery or suspense, you'll find it all at Thriller Fast. Open to readers, aspiring writers, and published authors. Learn craft, meet top thriller writers, and enjoy New York City July 11th through the 14th. Jack Higgins, R.L. Stine, Lee Child, Karen Slaughter, Catherine Coulter, Richard North Patterson, John Sanford, Ann Rule, and more. Join them this summer. Find out more at www.thrillerfest.com.
And I want to welcome everybody back here to the show. Again, I want to thank James Rollins for being on and to talk about his latest book, Bloodline. We are moving on here to our next guest, thriller master, New York Times bestselling author, creator of Rambo, as you might know, author David Morrell. David, thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you. I just came back from the airport with a flight lesson. I have my pilot's license, but I'm studying for my what's called the instrument rating, and it's very difficult. And anyhow, I had a really good lesson, so I'm flying high, as we might say.
But hey, you know what? That's the way to enjoy life. You're going out, you're flying high, you're living it fabulous, and you know, you've redone your website, which a lot of people, if they haven't been on it a little bit, might sit there and look and say, wow, David's really been doing some new stuff. It's davidmorrell.net, and like I said, you've done a lot of things. I just saw that they're re-releasing Rambo, they're re-releasing them all on Amazon. It came out in May 24th, so you got a lot of things going on. How has all this transition been? And now that we're a year past The Naked Edge, which you did with the Amazon exclusive, how was that experience moving forward and everything?
Well, you know, in 2009, publishing changed drastically with the improved Kindle. There's been a prior Kindle, which was somewhat big, and I'd not worked it, and I had the feeling maybe it was somewhat awkward. But in 2009, when the compact Kindle came out, the world changed for authors, and we could get into the debate about e-books versus printed books, and God knows, you know, I was a professor for many years, and I love printed books. But in today's publishing climate, publishers are not reprinting backlist books the way they used to. And one of the things that e-books, not just the Kindle, but, there's Barnes & Noble for the Nook and Scribd and Smashwords. And, there are a number of different vendors that provide e-books. But what they all have in common is that there need no longer be books that are out of print. And I love that idea that people who, especially somebody like me, I've been in this my 40th year, and inevitably as you go from publisher to publisher, you know, books come and go in terms of being in print. And I just threw myself into the whole idea of revising the texts, often writing introductions for them, and then making them available in what I began to think of as kind of archiving.
Mm-hmm. You know, the one thing that I discovered with e-books, which I thought were fabulous, and this is kind of what put me over the top of saying that I think that this is the perfect direction to go. And I know that people always have the debate of I like to hold the book in my hand and everything else.
Sure.
But the public domain books, when you're able to go back and read those books that were written, you know, those classics so far long ago, and instead of sitting there, people might not understand what public domain is that they're free because they've been written so long ago, and you could take, let's just say, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde for Robert Louis Stevenson. You can download those for free on your Kindle because Amazon has all those public domain books.
And I dare say they're available otherwise too, but yeah, because the copyrights were never strong to begin with, or else
right.
they simply ran out. And I'll give you a good example. I have a novel coming out this time next year called Murder as a Fine Art. And it was very, very exciting for me to do because it's my first pure historical thriller. It's set in 1854 London, and about a set of real murders, mass murders, that rivaled those of Jack the Ripper. And the main character is an actual person named Thomas de Quincey, who was an author of the period, just a wonderful author, and he was famous for writing the first book about drug addiction called Confessions of an English Opium Eater. He drank several pints of laudanum a day. He was really heavily into drugs, and I wanted to make him the main character of the novel, and I wanted to echo as many of his works as I could, such as the title Murder is a Fine Art comes from one of his essays called On Considering Murder as One of the Fine Arts. And as e-books, I found a collection of everything. I couldn't believe this. Everything. Yeah. De Quincey was really, really a busy guy, even despite the drugs. And he wrote, you know, millions of words. The volumes and volumes and volumes. I was able to get the whole thing for free.
Wow.
And I wouldn't have been able to get that even in a, you know, I would have had trouble finding it all in many libraries. So, I mean, this is a perfect example. And then, you know, I in the novel, a lot of the dialogue that De Quincey says comes right out of his fiction. So, in effect, I'm channeling the guy. He's still alive through me all these years later.
I mean, and just looking back at one of your novels, of course, and we're speaking here with author David Morrell. DavidMorrell.net is his new website. I challenge everyone, everybody, to go on there and view it and see everything new that he has going on there. But when you're looking back, I believe Rambo came out, First Blood, in 1972.
That's correct.
And, you know, I was only 2 years old. So when you're talking about people that were born in...
I was only 29, but
well,
I was 29.
Yeah, and I mean, you came out with, you know, this, and people that might have been born in the 90s and 2000, of course, know Sylvester Stallone and Rambo, this and that.
Yeah.
But now they're able to go back and rediscover where, you know, a book back then would be maybe very difficult for them to find, but with the e-books and with everything going on, now it's bam right there, and now they can rediscover everything.
Well, First Blood, fortunately, has never been out of print. It was published in 72, and I guess that would be one way of defining a classic. That was the first novel that Rambo appeared in. The first movie is called First Blood. Some people sometimes think it's called Rambo.
Right.
And the novel just stayed and stayed and stayed, and it's still in print after 40 years, and it's mighty gratifying. But some people know that I did novelizations for the second movie, Rambo First Blood Part 2, and the third movie, Rambo 3. And there was a whole saga between behind those novelizations. They went out of print in 1991. I deliberately let them go out of print because I just felt that the 90s, maybe I should let the books rest a little, but of late I got very interested in them, and I thought, you know, I haven't read them in years. I went back and looked at them, and my heavens, are they ever fun. And not only that, they're not the plot of the movie. I was sent so many scripts. I'm not too crazy about the third movie at all. Second movie's kind of fun. But the plots were very simple, whereas if I took all the scripts, especially one by James Cameron, who wrote a script that wasn't used for Rambo First Blood Part 2, and I put elements all together and added my own stuff and created something, really broke all the rules of novelization. And I got to thinking, you know, it might be fun to bring them back. So I went through them this spring. I revised the texts. I wrote lengthy, lengthy introductions explaining the whole phenomenon and the weirdness of what went on behind the scenes with regard to the scripts. And and finally, you know, now they're out as e-books in every format, and it's not something that could have been done. I guarantee that if I went to a mass market publisher and I said, I want to do these two novelizations, bring them back, they'd say, well, it hasn't been a movie in a while, and, you know, we're not doing reprints, and novelizations aren't what they used to be for the market. You know, you get all these excuses, and with the e-books, I just said, hell with it, I'll do it myself, you know, there they are, and people are really, really having a good time with them. I'm getting emails to tell me that, you know, that really makes the movies, it casts a whole different light on what the movies were.
Yeah, it's that reconnection he's one of the most famous American action characters that we've ever had.
Looking at it a certain way, there were five action characters in the 20th century that went from novels and into films and could be recognized all around the world. And they were in order: Sherlock Holmes, Tarzan, James Bond, Rambo, and Harry Potter. And now I'm not so sure that Tarzan would be recognized as much as he would have been even, say, 10 or 15, 20 years ago. But those are the five. And it's, you know, it's an objectively determined thing, because you can go anywhere in the world and know who Harry Potter or James Bond or Rambo or Sherlock Holmes these days. And, you know, it's really a kick. Anybody who says they set out to accomplish that is lying, because this is all, you know, there are too many elements of fate and the way culture changes. But, I mean, you have to have the material, has to be there to start with. But it's really, really cool to be able to think that I created a character that moves in those circles.
Now, the one thing I want to understand, too, is, you know, when you're looking around your site and you start reading, there's a lot of short stories and things that you wrote that I don't know
yes.
if they ever saw light of day, that now you're bringing out. And you have this book called Nightscape, which you kind of put the, you know, you're putting some of these short stories together. So were some
yeah.
of these never before released,
well,
those types of things?
Yeah. Again, going back to, this is my 40th year. I have written a lot.
Wow.
And a lot. I mean, 33 books and 70 short stories. And I did a lot of magazine work in the 90s for two very high-end, classy magazines for video and audio called Perfect Vision and Absolute Sound. And so what I, in the last year, as I said, I've been archiving. And it started with the website, and my dear friend Steve Barry had looked at my website, my previous one, which was 10 years old, and really showed it. And I confess, maybe I was getting a little lazy, and Steve, God bless him, gave me a bit of a lecture. He said, come on, man, get a new website. And I said, you know, you're absolutely right. So I got to thinking about what a website could be, and a lot of author websites are simply sales machines. They scream, buy me, buy me, buy me. And it's really not in my nature. You know what I'm like. I'm pretty laid back and not to be pushy and all that. And so I had the idea in collaboration with a website designer. The company's called Author Bytes, AUTHORBYTES. And I said to them, could we do a website that looked like a magazine? So that it would be about David Morrell, yes, but what we would be doing is not selling, we would be informing. And
right.
So we have all these photos as in a magazine. There's one really neat one of me with Sly as Rambo. We look like we're selling watches. It's really, really a cool photo. And there's photos of me doing my research, you know, with a submachine gun and rappelling off a cliff in Wyoming when I was with the National Outdoor Leadership School, and all kinds of other stuff, you know, and photos of my office and I don't know. They're just really cool photos. And in addition, we have a Rambo page, which has all this wealth of information in the form of an interview I wrote with myself, so to speak, about all the stuff that I get asked about Rambo. And we even, thinking of Steve Barry, we even used an essay that Steve Barry had written about First Blood, the novel, in a book called Thrillers 100 Must Reads. And then, you know, we went in other directions. And one of the challenges was, I've written novels, I've written nonfiction, I've done the Rambo stuff. I'm known kindly as a writer, as a fiction teacher, a teacher of fiction writing. And also we have, you know, these short stories. I have two collections, A Black Evening and Nightscape. But then I had all these other stories that, you know, the market for short story collections isn't what it used to be, and yet, you know, there we have the opportunity. So I've been releasing the long stories with introductions. They're about 10,000 words each for 99 cents. You know, it's a bargain. And then I decided, well, why not do the essays? Because I have a very long, informative, really interesting essay that I wrote about John Wayne's westerns for Perfect Vision, and then I had done one on Marilyn Monroe for Perfect Vision, I'm working now on putting together some things that I wrote about Frank Sinatra, the musician, and how he learned to breathe and how he learned to phrase. So that's going to be the next essay that comes out, e-essay, I should call it. And then I did this essay called Rambo and Me, The Story Behind the Story, which, again, has a whole lot of information, especially about how Audie Murphy, America's most decorated soldier of World War II, was the model for Rambo. So the website, you know, just to repeat, it's sort of like a magazine, and we found a way to put all this disparate material in a way that it makes perfect sense even to the most casual visitor to the site. So I'm just thrilled about it. And, you know, I mentioned Steve Barry, and to be gracious, I want to remind everybody that his new book, Columbus Affair, is just been published.
Yes, and you know what? And we interviewed Steve Barry about that too, and we call it an instant classic because it was kind of away from his Cotton Malone. But what I say your website is, and again, we're speaking with author David Morrell, and davidmorrell.net is the website that we're now talking about, is that it is a celebration of your 40 years of being in this business and what you brought to so many people and how you touched them. And like you were talking about your short story collection, you know, you started there with They, which was number one, and this is the fiction, and then you went on to My Name is Legion, The Interrogator, and The Architect of Snow, and then you just talked about your nonfiction ones. And that's just got to be something that, I mean, it's just so wonderful for you to be able to share. And I know that the fans love it to be able to see, like I said, the celebration and everything that you have given this industry over 40 years. It's just amazing.
Well, you know, when we talk privately at places like Thriller Fest, or when I meet other people, people often say that I exude what might be called good nature, and it's a characteristic that I really, really try to foster, and it's something I partly learned out of my son's death from cancer in 1987. But you know, just to when talking to people to be emotionally supportive, to be helpful and be part of the community, and to be nice, for lack of a better word, which is sort of not what you think of Rambo's creator as being. And that was another thing in the website with all the interviews and, you know, other free stuff that's on there and lots of essays about writing that are free, you know, just to try to communicate, you know, as I look back over the 40 years. And I've got, you know, plenty more stuff doing. But the idea was with this, it's really a beautiful, I mean, I really think it sets the standard for what a website can be. That I could communicate, you know, everything, the breadth and the excitement that I have felt over these 40 years.
And that's the one thing that when you're talking about, and I can't wait to see this new book because it just sounds fascinating that you said it's going to be out next year. And to see that your energy, you know, put into this, because that's the other thing that a lot of people have to realize, and it's very difficult, and there's a lot of authors that, you know, and they know how to write, and they know how to put the words correctly on the page, but what makes somebody, you know, a master like yourself, and like a Steve Barry, or like James Rollins before, is you put a little of yourself in every book, and I think that people will realize that when they read these stories, that there's a little bit of you in every book, instead of just words on a page. And
well,
I think that's the important. I think that's the separation.
When I was taught by, oddly enough, a science fiction writer named William Tenn, that was his professional name, Philip Klass was his real name, and he and I not only talked about writing, but we talked, you know, words on a page, but we also talked about, he said, you know, to have a career, when you think about, and I don't compare myself to these people, but when you think about Hemingway and Faulkner and Edith Wharton and John Steinbeck, a whole association of things comes to mind, a style, a place, a worldview, a personality. And he said, you know, the people who go the distance, who have long careers, are the ones who don't follow trends, don't chase the market, don't imitate other people, but just accept that they are what they are and that their work is channeled through the unrepeatable set of circumstances that made them what they are. You know, the fact that I was in an orphanage when I was young, and my mother was still alive, but she had to put me in an orphanage after my father died in the Second World War. And then She remarried a man. Well, she didn't remarry that man, but she, you know, when she remarried, the stepfather turned out to be not at all somebody who liked kids. And I lived in fear. I used to sleep under my bed in fear because of all the arguing that went on. And that's bound to, you know, that just crept into my personality. And it's no wonder that I write about people, you know, constantly needing to figure out how to defend themselves and constantly trying to keep their emotions under control and not panic in crisis situations and things of that sort. And so anyway, the short answer is, yeah, I think that you could, you know, in reading my material and seeing, you know, how one thing leads to another from book to book, you could almost write my biography just from reading the fiction.
And then that's the part that when, you know, your fans love to see, because like I said, I think that that's the separation. And the one thing that your fans can do if they get off their keister, we've been promoting this forever, is to go to Thriller Fest and be able to hear these things live, and you're going to be there again, and you're one of the first, and you're one of the founding people of the ITW, and you started this, and you've been going on. What's in store for Thriller Fest this year? Because the lineup is great, and we're just so sorry that we can't make it this year. We had to take this year off, but we were going to be coming next year. Yeah.
I always enjoy talking with you, John. And I need to point out that Gail Linz and I were the co-founders.
Yeah,
I always want to
make
sure I mention Gail. The Thriller Master is Jack Higgins, and we are somewhat disappointed because Jack's health, he's an elderly man, and basically, despite all his best intentions, he won't be able to be there. What he's going to do is he's having a presentation videotaped. So he'll be there in spirit, and we'll be able to see him in a videotape form. But Lee Child is a featured guest. John Sanford is a featured guest. I should have a sheet in front of me because there are so many. Karen Slaughter, I believe, is going to be a featured person. And on and on. Gosh, there's a woman writer, and it's just going right by me, and I'm going to feel terrible when we're done, and I can't think of the name. But MGM used to say that they had more stars than are in the heavens, and Thriller Fest and ITW for, you know, this event, which is always in New York City in the second week of July. The amount of good nature and generosity from the very biggest names, R.L. Stein, Sandra Brown, they like to come to these events and they mix and mingle, and there are just so many really, really gifted people. Joseph Finder, I've not trapped myself, John, because I'm not at the point where somebody's going to say, well, you so-and-so, you didn't mention me. And all I can do is say it was an inadvertent error. But, you know, there'll be, you know, just the best. And in days of, you know, if you're a writer, you get to mingle with agents and you get to be part of, I'm going to be doing a talk about structure in a way that it gets away from the standard triangle structure and gets into some other ways to structure a book. And then, you know, we have the Thriller Fest itself with all these wonderful people, authors who are willing to talk about their, you know, their books so that readers can have a good time at this, too. We get about 1,000 people, and I just have myself, I have a wonderful time.
Yeah, that's one of the things, and we always try to tell authors, especially up and coming, for two things, is to make sure that you hit Craft Fest. And one of our good friends, and you probably know her too, is Allison Leota. She was there a couple years ago, and now you know, she's taken all of that and look where she's at nowadays. And you've starting to see like Brett King and a lot of these other authors that maybe had one book out, and all of a sudden, boom, now they're starting to, you know, it helps because it's something that you know, that you guys didn't have when you guys were coming up, is to be able to have these kind of events. And
we
the one
not.
Thing that people should know is Thriller Fest is whenever it is going on, that's going to be the hottest time of the year in New York City. And that's weather-wise for some reason.
It's broiling, but if you stay indoors, hey, you know, it'll just be like being in Milwaukee.
That's
because
true. You'll never know.
You'll just be indoors, right? just be indoors. Yeah. You don't need to step outdoors at all. It is hot, but the whole idea of ITW as a two-pronged thing, International Thriller Writers, was to allow thriller writers to associate with each other in a way that made them learn from one another and be better at what they do, and also to float other writers' boats. We've really, really helped a lot of writers. I mean, there's many, many writers that even in the 7 years that ITW has existed that maybe wouldn't have had their breaks if not for the opportunities we provided. It's a very, very generous, good-natured organization.
Yeah, and that craft or that Ancient Fest is just like, I mean, it's priceless. I mean, it's worth the price of admission. Where else are you going to be able to sit there and possibly get in front of, you know, 10 to 15 agents, live agents pitching your work? You're not going to have that opportunity ever.
And a few places have agents come and name agents, but usually it's maybe one or two, you know, depending on how far they have to travel, whereas...
Right.
Thrillerfest is in New York City, and I think we have something like 30 name agents that just make themselves available, and if somebody wants to pitch a book to them, there they are.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a rare opportunity.
Well, I'll tell you what, David, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's always a pleasure to speak with you, I mean, because you're one of the pioneers in the changing publishing and everything that's going on, and people should just, you know, realize to wake up that things are changing, and
yes.
It's one of those things that's coming, and you can't stop it, so you might as well embrace it, and you might as well use it to your advantage.
Yes, you can't remain still. You must move forward, and that's another way of saying that we're all creative. If you're truly creative, you adapt.
Correct. So, David, enjoy. Have fun with your instruments.
Yeah, my instruments.
Make sure you read them right.
I fly with these view-limiting devices. I never get to look outside. All I get to look at is the gauges on the... on the control panel.
Yeah, you don't want to end up in Albany if you're going to New York
City.
No,
I don't.
Sure,
definitely. No. Milwaukee, maybe.
All right. Well, you enjoy yourself and have fun, and we will speak with you later.
All right. Thank you so much, John.
All right. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is author David Morrell, davidmorrell.net. So many things that David is involved in. Like he said, he re-released a lot of things with the Rambo series and a lot of short stories and things that are out there and available on Amazon for ebook. And he just keeps going and going. And we're so excited to hear about his new book coming out next year because that just sounds fascinating. Anything David does, touches, is just instant classic gold. So if you haven't really discovered him, I really don't know what you're smoking. So davidmorrell.net to see everything that he's done and go start, you know, pick. You won't find a bad one. Just go on and pick a book, say, this looks interesting, and read it, and then you're going to start, all of a sudden, by the time you know it, you're going to have his library as one of your libraries. We are going to be back here with our next guest coming up, Brian Gurley, and he is the author of the Starvation Lake Mystery Series. The third book is The Skeleton Box, which came out June the 5th. So we will be back in just a couple minutes and with Brian. Next. I know you guys were all singing to True by Spandau Ballet, and I do apologize. And if you want to listen to it further, you can go download it and listen to it. Because right now, we are going to be joined here by our last guest. And again, I want to thank James Rollins and David Morrell, who were just on previously. Go check them out at jamesrollins.com and davidmorrell.net. Brian Gurley is an author that kind of came on our radar a couple years ago with his book Starvation Lake, and it was a Starvation Lake mystery series, and we just started falling in love with it. Now we're already on book three because time flies and I don't know where it goes. And it's called The Skeleton Box, came out June the 5th. We're so pleased to be able to speak with Brian again. We had had him on the show previous talking about this series. So, Brian, thank you so much for coming on. How you doing?
Hey, I'm great, John. Thanks for having me. Love to be on the show.
Yeah, so like we said, Skeleton Box, already book three, and, you know, we had you on, I think it was for Starvation, like the first one, and the second book in the series was called The Hanging Tree. So how has the series kind of progressed in Skeleton Box, a little bit about it and behind the scenes kind of stuff?
Sure. Well, for readers who aren't familiar with it, these books are set in the fictional town of Starvation Lake, Michigan, in northern lower Michigan, not in the UP. And they're narrated by Gus Carpenter, who's the associate editor at the little paper there, the Pine County Pilot. And in The Skeleton Box, which begins in March of 2000, there's been a series of burglaries in town where somebody is breaking into homes on bingo night when they know the elderly folks there will be at the bingo at St. Valentine's Catholic Church. And what's odd about it, John, is this person is not taking anything. He or she is rifling through files, and they're looking for something, but they're not finding it. And then one of the burglaries goes bad, and we end up with a woman who's a beloved citizen, whose name is Phyllis Bontrager. She's dead. She's dead in the house of B. Carpenter, who is our narrator, Gus Carpenter's mother, and she's the mother of Gus's on-again, off-again love of his life, Darlene Esper. We take off from there, and there's a number of other things going on in Starvation Lake at the time. And as Gus probes what the heck happened that night, he begins to think that it might have something to do with the disappearance of a nun from Starvation Lake 60 years before. So it gets a little complicated, but a lot of good old characters and a few new ones who are a lot of fun as well.
Yeah, and that's the thing that, you know, that is interesting about the series that you do because, you know, you have some of the same characters, but it's more about the town, everything that kind of wraps itself around. And you were actually one of the inspirations that we had as far as, because we just launched our Green Lake series, which is an original that we're writing, which is kind of about the town and the things associated with it, where, and we kind of, from writing and seeing kind of how you wrote together, it was kind of like something that we kind of inspired from. And that's a little bit different. Yeah, which people have to understand, you know, because a lot of series are mainly just about, okay, it's just about the character. But you bring this whole fictional world together, and that's a monumental task. But it's also fun watching it move forward because you're moving the everything forward, not just the characters in the book.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think of Starvation Lake, the town, as one of the characters. You know, obviously, it doesn't talk or go to Audrey's Diner, but it's part of the character, you know, the populace and the geography and its past. And in all three books, the things that happen in the present force the people of the town and Gus, our narrator, to confront truths from the past and decide whether they should be known or not. And, you know, I know that people like to say truth will set you free. Well, I think in this book, you might question that. In fact, Gus's mom says the truth might not set you free, son, but here's the truth.
And the other thing is that, you know, just about the books and everything and, you know, moving forward, when you started writing, you know, Starvation Lake, did you have an idea kind of how far you thought the series were going to go? Was it kind of open-ended? And again, we're speaking here with author Brian Gurley. The website is briangurley.com, bryangrulley.com. So did you kind of have any idea about that?
No. It's funny, John. People are now saying, well, you've written the trilogy. And, you know, trilogy is fraught with these bigger implications. You know, J.R.R. Tolkien, he wrote a trilogy. George Lucas produced a trilogy. You know, I'm a newsman, basically. That's my day job. And for me, the kind of vision required for a trilogy, the vision is, you know, ordering two beers at last call. So, you know, I wrote Starvation Lake not even knowing it was a mystery. I didn't know it would be published. I had no ideas for anything further. In fact, after Touchstone gave me a three-book deal, my editor made me change the ending to the first book because she said, you've written it as if you're never going to write about this place again and we want people to come back. So I had to change it. Then I wrote a second book that I threw away because it was terrible. And then I wrote The Hanging Tree. And then I wrote The Skeleton Box. So I've really written four books, and thank God nobody's ever going to see that other one. But, you know, in retrospect, it sort of is an accidental trilogy in the sense that there is a theme, a few things that run through all three books, but one in particular, and that is the relationship between Gus and his mother, V. And it asks that question as to whether the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth really strains or strengthens the bonds of family and love and friendship.
Now, you just mentioned you just threw away a book, but did you take, but are you going to, but there has to be something good about it that you maybe can take and move forward. Now, maybe not the whole thing, but
I did take some scenes from the Thrownaway book, which didn't even have a title. That's a bad sign. No title. You probably don't know what you're doing, but I took some of the scenes and they showed up in Hanging Tree. And there's one little bit from that Thrownaway book that shows up actually in the Skeleton Box. But, you know, 89.9% of it I just threw away.
You said, screw it.
And, you know, it's just, I didn't do a good job, but, I'm still learning. And each book is difficult. People ask me, do they get easier? No. They really don't. No, at least not for me. And you'd think you'd get better at things doing them over and over, but I've played golf, so I know that that's not realistic.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one. One of the greatest lines I ever heard actually came from the record business was, your first album should always be one of your best because you had your whole life to do it. But then going after that, now you're up against the deadline, and they're like, nope, you got to have it done in 8 months. So then that's when the pressure really mounts.
I think that's exactly right. And when I turned in that Thrownaway book, like 2 weeks before the Starvation Lake came out, and I knew it wasn't very good, and my editor confirmed that, but, you know, there was a lot of pressure there. I was at a book signing on my first tour here, you know. It's my dream come true. I've written a novel, and I'm out there signing books. But at the same time, I knew I had this really troubled manuscript. And one of my buddies asks me, at a book signing, did it ever cross your mind that maybe you only have one book in you? And I thought, yeah, about 30 seconds ago.
Thanks for that negativity, dude.
Yeah, well, he didn't know. It was a fine question. He's an old friend, and it was innocent. So I'm at three now, and hopefully I'll write some more.
Yeah, well, you said that you were signed to a three-book deal. Again, Brian Gurley is who we're talking to. The book is Skeleton Box, came out June 3rd in the Starvation Lake Mystery Series. But you said that you got a three-book deal, so now have they signed you up for three more?
Not yet. I mean, they want me to come back and write a couple more at least, and I actually have done a plan for a fourth book. It would still be in Starvation Lake, but it would take place 12 years later.
Okay.
So we jump forward in time, and Gus would be married to Darlene, and Darlene is a sheriff, and Starvation Lake is prosperous for the first time because of a natural gas drilling boom, which they have in Michigan. They have natural gas. And with those booms come good things and bad things, so some bad stuff happens. But I also have a different idea that has nothing to do with Starvation Lake or Gus, and I'm thinking about that. And right now I'm just trying to enjoy my tour and keep my day job, and figure out what's next.
Yeah, I mean, that's got to be the one thing, too, just from starting off, is how different has it been from, you know, like you said, your first book tour? So it's always kind of a new thing when you have to kind of go out there and you got to put yourself in front of the fans, and you got to hear the good, and sometimes you got to hear the bad. How's it been for you kind of on the road with your, you know, with the book tour?
Well, I love doing it. It's, you know, what a great pleasure. Somebody else is paying most of the bills for you to go around and talk about your books.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you get a really good turnout. Once in a while you don't, but whoever it is, whether it's 2 people or 100, you do your best and you have fun. And inevitably, I meet somebody new who's fun and interesting and has good suggestions or thoughts or just loves the books, or I see old friends that I haven't seen. Like, I was in San Francisco, and a buddy of mine from Notre Dame, where I matriculated, he showed up. I hadn't seen him in 20 years, and it was like a gift. You know, I get to see these people, and I wouldn't see him if I wasn't out on a book tour, so that's cool. It's fun.
And what's one of the biggest things you're getting emails about now that you're into the third book? Because, you know, now you've been able to, you know, get yourself into people's lives now for many hours of entertainment. So what's one of the one things that they're kind of bringing to you that maybe you didn't even realize you were kind of touching them that way while you were writing it?
I think
I know that's
mostly
a deep question, and I just thought of that off the top of my head.
No, that's good. That's a good question. I think mostly it's the relationship between Gus and his mom. People ask me about it, and I don't want to give anything away, but there are some bittersweet moments in the skeleton box as regards to that relationship. And then the other thing everybody wants to know is what's next. When's the next Starvation Lake book? Or are you going to do something else, or what? And I don't know for sure now, but I should know pretty shortly, in a week or two.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that you have to like is when you're out there and you're listening to the people, you actually do get an idea of knowing. Because you get the reviews from, you know, like us and Publishers Weekly and other magazines and things like that. But the fans are the ones that really tell you whether or not your writing is, I guess you want to say, kind of like how your writing is like a fan.
Well, whether you're
like
connecting.
Yeah,
whether or not you're
connecting with the fans. And I guess
right.
That's the sense that you get, and that's the good thing when you're out there.
Yeah. And, you know, there are people who come and ask little tiny questions about stuff in the town or about Gus, and you can tell they're really into the book. Sometimes they remind me of things I've forgotten from the first two books.
Yeah.
And that's really fun. You know, now and then I go to book clubs, I get to hear people argue about my characters. I just sit in there watching them argue. Because some people like, you know, Darlene, and some don't, for instance. And, you know, I don't have an opinion on it. I just, there she is. Take her or not, and with all the characters, that's true, and it's fun to listen to that.
Yeah, again, this is author Brian Grueley, and the book is The Skeleton Box, the third in the Starvation Lake Mystery, briangrueley.com, to find a lot more going on with you. So, you know, what's going on, besides writing? You know, what do you do, we know you have your day job and everything else, but when you're not writing, kind of how are you kind of relaxing yourself? Kind of how are you kind of getting away from the grind of having to sit in front of the computer and be creative?
Well, I my day job actually fits in well because I write long narrative features for Bloomberg Business Week magazine. And it's a different exercise than fiction, but it's also the same. In the end, you want to write stories that get people in their room and keep them there, hook them and keep them there. And so you need some of the same stuff. You know, you need tension, you need dialogue, you need character, you need setting. And in this case, I can't make it up. I got to go get it. And that's fun to do, to go to, you know, I've been to Brazil and Oklahoma City, Japan in the last 6-7 months to do stories. And that's fun. And all the time I'm still learning about how best to tell a story and how to tell it so that I get those readers interested. So that's fun. And I play hockey, and my wife and I, we really like to just go out to dinner, go to the theater in Chicago, and we have a great whole summer ahead of us here in Chicago that we're looking forward to. It's a great city in the summer. So, you know, I'm busy, but that's the best way to be. The alternative is not as good.
Now, the one thing, and you're probably one of the best people to ask, is this. Do you have any stock tips?
No. Yeah, don't listen to my stock tips. Buy low, sell high. That's the best I can tell you. I don't really buy stocks because we have ethical policies. You can't own stocks and companies you're writing about. I could write about any company, so I only own mutual funds. So you don't want to listen to my advice about stocks, believe me.
But, you know, the funny thing is that, I mean, when you just look at how everything's going in the business and the Wall Street and everything else, I mean, there are so many flippin' suspense, thriller, mystery stories you could write about just that alone. I mean, you got to see things that go on every day that you almost have to scribble on a pad and say, oh, that's going to make a hell of a story one day. I got to remember that.
Well, you know,
those types of things.
In a way, I do. I don't really write that much about Wall Street per se, but for instance, I told you a few minutes ago about this Fourth Starvation Lake book I might do, which involves a drilling boom, and I wrote a story for Business Week about what's going on oil-wise in the oil industry up in North Dakota. And North Dakota's got a lot of money flying at them, and they have a lot of problems up there because of you know, this influx of people from out of state, and there's nowhere to live, and housing prices are through the roof, and crime is up. And so, you know, I seeing that firsthand would help me inform, you know, will inform the book I write that's set in Starvation Lake.
If you had to pick one character out of your books to say, I'm just going to take this character, and let's say you're going to move them out of Starvation Lake, and they're going to do something on their own, who do you think that would be?
I think it would, I never really thought about this, probably Joni McCarthy, she's not in the second book, but she's in the first one. She's Gus's young reporter, and she shows up again in the skeleton box. She's down in Detroit now. She's in her late 20s. She's a little, you know, more mature and different than she was in the first book. And, you know, she's in a totally different place. So I think you could follow Joni somewhere else and see what she does. She's a lot of fun.
Is she one of those characters that, like, where, you know, we always ask authors, you know, there's always that one character that when you first started writing and when you first started getting into the book, you didn't realize that they were going to have as big of a voice that they did. Which one of your characters do you think is like that, that's kind of come out of nowhere that you didn't even see coming, that kind of has this big, gigantic voice, like I said, that you just didn't see coming?
I think it probably Gus's mom, which, mm-hmm. you know, I knew that he had to have, you know, he's from Starvation Lake, he had to have at least one parent alive still, I thought. Mm-hmm. But I never thought of her initially as a major character, and I think over the course of the three books, and I think many of my readers would agree, that she is, aside from Gus, the most important character. Even though other characters get more airtime, as it were, it's Bee's caginess and Bee's love for Gus and her various decisions and her own past that inform his character more than anybody else. So that's a great question.
Yeah, and I think that's the important part. Is, like you said, they might not get as much airtime, but the significance in what they do adds so much depth to the story that's what makes them kind of that important when you're writing them. And it's just something that you really don't see until all of a sudden you kind of go back through and you're like, damn, they're really important.
Yeah, well, you know, the sheriff, Dingus Aho, is also – you know, a guy I think I thought of as too utilitarian at first. And in the first book, I was probably midway through and I started to figure out what Dingus had at stake in this investigation of this hockey coach's death. And when I figured that out, it really changed the rest of the book profoundly. And so he's around all three books. And he's a fun guy, too. He's fun to write. I like Dingus. He can be a pain in the butt, but He's a fun guy to write.
Yeah, and just real quick too, is because I've never quite seen this. Is why did you pick Bingo Night for this?
I have no idea.
Bingo players, man.
Yeah, there's bingo up there, and I wanted these break-ins to happen, and for there to be some reason for it, and it's just somebody who's clever enough to figure out, well, not that clever, you know, these people are going to be gone, and I got to go there. But
right.
There's only certain people this person is selecting, and well, now I'm starting to get into the book itself, so I guess
there's a reason behind why it's Bingo Night and why it's these certain people, and that's kind of the whole, you know, the whole plot kind of behind everything is what's going on and what do they have in common and things
it's,
of that nature.
Yeah, it's definitely not an arbitrary choice.
Right, very calculated, I guess you want to say.
Oh, that's me, John. I'm so calculating.
See? Calculating.
Mostly I'm winging it. Peter the Pan's
hey,
author.
Yeah, but you got to have fun when you're doing it. And there's got to be one. Yeah, and there's got to be one scene in the book. And you don't have to give a lot of it away, but there's got to be one scene when you go back and you reread it and you're doing it and you finally finished and you're sitting there and you say, damn, I nailed it. And I nailed that scene and I really got it out the way that I wanted to have it. Did you get that sense when you were in it, when you were writing it, when you were finished and you went back and read it?
Well, I haven't gone back to read very much, but in my head, the scenes I can remember loving to write, there were two of them. One they're both down in Detroit, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And one's at a golf course where Gus and Joni go to meet this priest. And the other is in some people might call it a speakeasy. It's an after-hours joint, and where Gus goes to meet Joni. And it's based on a bar I used to go to after hours years, you know, 25 years ago in Detroit. And it was just fun to be there again. I call it something else other than it was. And to see Joni again after, you know, she was totally absent from the hanging tree. That whole night I loved, you know, they end up in this bar and then they're back at her place in the Eastern Market in Detroit. It was really fun to write those scenes. So they're the ones I enjoy. Did I nail them? I guess I can go back and find out, but sometimes you don't want to go back.
That's true. I mean, I can understand. It's just, you know, like when we're sitting there and I'm going through and, you know, we're doing our Green Lake and we're writing all these things going on, is that there's just that time and that light goes on that when you're done, you're just like, wow, I really wrote it the way that I wanted people to see it. And I guess that's just kind of an epiphany that you kind of get as a, you know, as an author, that you did it correctly. Then you just have to hope that people actually are in your head and actually understand what you were trying to write.
Right, right. Exactly right. So I'm very proud of the book. It was very difficult to write. And when I turned it in, I had a long, uncomfortable conversation with my editor where she was asking me questions about my own book and I didn't know how to answer them. Because so many things happened in the past, in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, all the way in every decade up to the present time of the book that I hadn't done the work of figuring out exactly when all those things happened and put them in order. And so I had to go back and do that. I did this long timeline that starts in the year 1903. Mm-hmm. And most of the stuff in the timeline isn't in the book, but I had to know it. And basically rewrote the book. I didn't throw away a book in this case. I had a lot of good stuff there. I just had to figure it out more clearly for myself so that the reader didn't have to do too much work. And I'm done. And I think there's a sense of closure of some of the issues raised in the two earlier books and in this one at the end of this book. And that was gratifying to me, at least personally, and I hope it is to readers as well.
Well, Brian, we want to thank you so much for coming on today and talking about The Skeleton Box, the third book here in the Starvation Lake Mystery Series, briangruley.com, briangruley is how you spell it.
Exactly.
So, Brian, we want to thank you so much for coming on. Looking forward to seeing, you know, not only coming up in the future and everything you got going on, but if you decide to kind of jump out of Starvation Lake and maybe into something else, you know, it would be fascinating to kind of see what you got going on. And maybe if you write any, like, little short e-book novels or, you know, novellas to kind of whatever, anything you got going on, it's just, we'd just love to know. So let us know what's going on.
All right. I'll keep you posted, John. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I hope to see you soon on the trail.
Yeah. You too, Brian. We appreciate it.
All right, man. Thank you.
All right. You have a good one. Thanks a lot.
See you.
All right. So, again, everybody, that is author Brian Gruley. And the book is The Skeleton Box, came out June 5th. You can find out all the information by going to Brian's website. You can go ahead and go back and read Starvation Lake, Hanging Tree, if you have not read those two books, to really submerge yourself. Like we said, it's one of those different kinds of series where the city, where the town is actually, like he said, a character in the book, which moves forward, living, breathing entity that you'll be able to see and really get yourself into, along with the people that are involved in the city and everything going on. It's very unique, very something that's not really seen out there, and I think that all thriller fans and suspense fans will really get the idea of, you know, what Brian's trying to do and just be able to sink your teeth into, because it is something that is so different and written so well. We also want to thank, again, author James Rollins, jamesrollins.com, and his book, which comes out on Tuesday, called Bloodline, which is the eighth book in his Sigma Force series. And after that, we were able to interview author David Morrell. DavidMorrell.net is the website, and all the things that he has going on, re-releasing a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff about Rambo and a lot of other things that he has written over the past that has never been seen before, so you want to check out DavidMorrell.net. We have come to the end here. Check out our website, SuspenseMagazine.com. Click on the Suspense Radio icon to see everybody that's coming up, because I'll tell you, the lineups that we have going on are just absolutely phenomenal, and I think that you guys will all enjoy them. If you have any questions, email us at editor@suspensemagazine.com. Download Green Lake for free right on our website. I want to thank everybody again for joining us. We will see you guys all next time.